This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 27 days since the campfire started. Butte County had a severe housing crisis before the fire. Now it's scrambling for places to put the people who lost some 14,000 homes in Paradise, Magalia, and Concow. We'll talk with the director of the County Housing Authority. We'll also hear what happened with the rebuilding effort after the Thomas Fire, which erupted a year ago near Santa Barbara. Plus, the founder and CEO of Sierra Nevada Brewing, Ken Grossman, shares the story of Resilience, a new brew raising funds around the country for fire recovery. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, December 5th, 2018, this is After Paradise. At the base of Maslow's hierarchy of needs are the very basics of life: food, water, warmth, and rest. It's fair to say that a roof over your head qualifies for those needs. And throughout Butte County, fire victims are asking themselves where and how they're going to provide that roof for themselves and their families. The fire leveled some 14,000 homes, and authorities have been scrambling ever since to figure out short, medium, and long-term shelter for the people who lived in them. Last night at the Chico City Council meeting, City Manager Mark Orme said officials are doing their best to improvise.
There's no book on when your population grows by 10 to 20% in 24 hours. This just is not the norm, so we are writing the book on this.
The council unanimously approved a series of emergency ordinances to encourage construction of small, affordable housing units. Butte County Housing Authority Executive Director Ed Mayer joins us in studio. And Ed, your response to the City Council's actions?
First of all, it's very exciting that the City Council is moving in this direction because it is a very concrete step in response to the disaster. The issue, though, is does it come timely? I mean, how fast can we produce units? And we had a housing crisis before the campfire in that we really had no local availability of housing units for our clients, our low-income clients. They had an extremely difficult time finding housing. It would take many of our clients upwards of 6 months to secure a unit. So we had a severe housing crunch to start. Now we have an additional 14,000 displaced families. We don't know how many of those right now are actually needing housing here because they've dispersed. But the important thing here is our community's capacity to absorb a disaster. And when I speak about community, I'm talking about the larger community, as in the North State or much less California. What becomes so painfully acute here is this idea that we don't have housing. We don't have the capacity in our state to absorb a disaster like this. I mean, if you look at the millions of households in California, we're only talking 14,000 here in Butte County.
Right.
Theoretically, you could distribute them through the state with little impact, but there is no availability of housing in the state overall. So
right.
What this really illuminates in a graphic fashion is this idea that we in California have systematically created a situation where we cannot produce housing sufficient for our citizenry, much less housing that will allow us to absorb a disaster like this.
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
So what do you do? I mean, what do you do in the interim? Where are people now? Where are you putting people?
Okay, so right now, people are going a variety of directions. Are there those who've already received insurance payouts on their insured home and they've already bought property in Chico or Red Bluff or Redding or in the area? We had about 320 families in the disaster areas who had Section 8 rental assistance. They're able to take that rental assistance anywhere in the United States and use it, so that's good. We have about, as I understand it, 700 households in emergency shelters right now,
right.
Run by the Red Cross. And then we know anecdotally of a lot of households living doubled up here in Chico and in the Oroville areas. The exciting thing, the opportunity in all of this is for Butte County as a whole and its jurisdictions of Chico and Oroville and Gridley, we have an opportunity to show the rest of the state through deregulation how we can actually get after our housing issues in this state. In other words, we've created a regulatory framework that has really become an obstacle to providing housing for our citizenry.
Can you very briefly explain to us what that is?
Sure. So, for example, Prop 13.
Mm-hmm.
Prop 13 has done well to serve the interests of those who own property in the state, whether it's commercial or residential, but has come at the expense of our seniors and our youth and our emerging households households that are forming, they don't have housing opportunity in the state. So Prop 13 has distorted the state's tax structure and has resulted in a system where new development is asked to carry the burden of development impacts for an entire community, which is not necessarily fair.
How does then what the city council has done, how does that fit into what they are restricted by statewide?
I will say that the state is gearing up to spend a lot of money on housing and special needs housing, which is fabulous. Props 1 and Props 2 were reflective of that. But and this legislature is spending a lot of time on housing-related issues. But we have yet to start really unwinding the system we've built over the last 40 years.
And that's not going to help the 14,000 families that
not today
that don't have a home.
That's correct. So we really are in a situation where I hate to say it, realistically, we're going to see many, many households displaced out of Butte County. We have no ability to produce 6, 8, 10,000 units overnight. That's just not going to happen. So the reality is where do they go? By hook or by crook, we'll be trying to refer households elsewhere in the state wherever possible. And if you have family in Arizona or family in Montana, go and get taken care of. So we've just witnessed Butte County, 15% of our corporate body just went away in terms of the number of households, the businesses that supported them, the jobs that they represented. Our county just shrank. But we have this displaced population, what's effectively a refugee population now, that we really have to work on.
Even if you had your ideal environment, you know, with housing units available, there is still absolutely no way you could have absorbed the magnitude of the housing loss here, is there? I mean, it still would have been a massive issue.
Well, it is a massive issue, especially relative to the size of this county
right.
and its resources. What's interesting is we've had disasters like this before in our history. So if you go back in history and go back to the 1930s, during the Dust Bowl era, there were a lot of refugees that came out of the Midwest that came to California looking for better opportunity. They were as welcome here as our homeless are welcome here today. But in those days, the federal government took action and built 6 refugee camps up and down the Central Valley of California.
You're suggesting refugee camps here in California?
You know what? We've done it before.
Fire refugees?
What else do you do? I mean, where else are you going to put these households? We do have this capacity, and we've done it before. I mean, we have these expectations that everyone gets to live in a 3-bedroom house with 2-car garage, mm-hmm. 2-bath, and everyone gets to live happily ever after. Well, we need to adjust our attitudes here. I hate to say that. We need to open our minds to new possibilities for housing.
So unless and until all of these changes happen, what do you do?
Many things. The most immediate thing here is we've just gone through a first responder stage. We're now in the mode of making sure that we can find families that need help, identify their needs, get them sheltered and safe. And then the next step here is medium and long-term housing solutions, shipping folks to wherever they can find assistance from relatives and friends, being able to take households one by one out of the emergency shelters and refer them for housing or services or sometimes both. This is now a triage process. We're looking at vetting properties right now for the placement of FEMA's manufactured housing units. And we think there may be as many as 2,000 units brought into this county. There's a lot of planning work going on for how to address this over a long time. And I expect that Paradise's reconstruction will probably take 20, 25 years before you have a community where you wouldn't recognize that a disaster had occurred. This is a long road ahead of us.
That's Butte County Housing Authority Executive Director Ed Mayer. This type of devastating fire is becoming the norm in California. 1 year ago this week, the Thomas Fire broke out near Santa Barbara, destroying nearly 800 homes. Many of those houses were, like those in Paradise, built in areas where the risk of wildfire is known to be high. New homes are required to meet stricter state building codes that are designed to make them less likely to burn. But the massive fires of the past 2 years are calling into question how effective those codes are. Emily Guerin reported from Ventura for our sister station KPCC in Southern California.
You need a A year ago, Nancy Bowman turned on the TV at her mother-in-law's place. It was the first morning of the Thomas fire, and she had fled her house in the Ventura foothills the night before. She made this recording on her phone.
Come on, boys, save our house, please.
On TV, her neighbor's house was completely on fire. Firefighters were standing in her driveway, hosing down her garage.
That other guy's house is gone. Oh, they were so nice.
Her house survived, but four of the nine houses on her street and Dora Lane were gone. I asked her about it 10 months later.
So were you surprised that these houses burned?
Totally shocked. Totally blown away because look, it's stucco and a concrete roof.
She wasn't the only one who was surprised. After the first night of the Thomas fire, Ventura Fire Marshal Joe Morelli cruised the city, checking out the damage. The devastation on Nancy Street and Dora Lane, it really stood out to him.
What I noticed on that street is that the homes appeared to be of newer construction. Half were there and half were gone.
So he started looking to see if they had fire-resistant features, which are required on all homes built after 2008 in high fire-risk areas.
7/8-inch stucco, attic vents and eaves, dual-pane windows. The roof is Class A material, and then wire mesh over attic vents.
And Dora Lane was a brand new subdivision, so it had all that stuff. But even many of the older houses that burned in the Thomas fire had some fire-resistant features. According to CAL FIRE data, 80% of the houses destroyed in the Thomas fire had fire-resistant exteriors, and 90% had fire-resistant roofs. Now, we still don't have the data from the big fires this fall. But to fire ecologists like Alexandra Seifert with the Conservation Biology Institute, it's becoming increasingly clear that houses built in risky places are impossible to fireproof.
You can make a big difference in increasing the potential safety of your house, but you can't guarantee that it's not going to burn.
Her research has found that where you build your house, not what it's made of, is the biggest factor in determining whether it will burn. But approving new development is done by cities and counties, which often have a financial incentive to do so. The state tries to guide them to do the right thing. But as Pete Munoa, CAL FIRE's Deputy Chief of Land Use Planning, says,
but at the end of the day, it's up to the local jurisdiction to protect their citizens.
He says so far, it's really only academics who are discussing giving the state more control over where houses are built in fire-prone areas.
They talk about that all the time. They shouldn't be building there, period, is what I've heard a few of the professors state. Okay, that's easier said than done. Where do you put those folks, and how do you compensate them for that?
Meanwhile, in Ventura, Andorra Lane is already being rebuilt. The houses are going up in the exact same place, under the exact same building codes as before the Thomas fire. That's actually quite common. A study published earlier this year in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found rates of home construction are higher in the footprint of wildfires than in surrounding areas. Yolanda Bundy is the chief building official with the city of Ventura. She told KPCC earlier this year that the city's just not focused on changing building codes or overhauling land use planning.
Right now, all the efforts are concentrated on helping people rebuild their home, not to create more rules or regulations or more processes.
And that, some fire scientists say, means we're still not learning from our mistakes. Covering the environment, I'm Emily Guerin.
You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. Thank you. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Viglund. The Butte County Sheriff's Office continues to lift evacuation notices, zone by zone, to allow residents from the disaster area back to see their properties. If you are going back to your property, you'll need to show ID, and on the way up to Paradise, you'll be given a reentry kit. Lisa Almaguer is with the Butte County Department of Public Health.
Environmental Health has put together what we call reentry kits, and they include a full-body Tyvek suit, nitrile gloves, an N95 mask, and the kit also has a hazard advisory and health and safety precautions pamphlet. And we encourage everyone to read through this pamphlet in advance. It is on the website on the buttecountyrecovers.org, so it's accessible to review ahead of time. These fire-impacted areas, evacuees will encounter dangerous conditions. They will be exposed to hazardous materials, and so we are highly recommending that evacuees utilize these items. And after they visit their properties, they can go ahead and discard these items and place them into the plastic bag that they came in and leave them on their property. The bag will then be removed by hazardous waste and debris removal professionals.
Speaking from personal experience, when you are up there, on the properties, it's not easy to see that they are toxic. Can you tell us a little bit about what people could be exposed to?
Absolutely. So what we know is when everyday household items are exposed to extremely hot temperatures from a wildfire, they become hazardous materials. So everything that you've got in your cupboards, in your garage, cleaning products, spray paint cans, batteries, all of these things become hazardous materials. They become very fine particles in the ash and debris.
And what does that potentially mean for your own health?
Well, once these household items become hazardous and they are in the ash and debris, when you visit your property and you go to identify items that you might recognize, mementos, you will be immediately and directly exposed to that hazardous material. So you need to take the steps to protect your body, your lungs, your skin, your hands and feet from exposure. What we know from recent fires in California is that property destroyed by the fire contain high and concerning levels of things like heavy metals, lead, mercury, dioxins, arsenic, and other carcinogens. So these lead to acute or chronic health effects, anything from burning skin to respiratory issues, to potentially cancer down the line.
And presumably some families may be thinking about bringing the entirety of their family up to see the property. What is your advice on bringing children into the disaster zone?
So bringing children to the destroyed homes and property is not recommended. The best protection for children is to keep them away from the hazardous ash and debris. They are very inquisitive by nature and will likely touch the ash. They will likely look for toys. They might not even understand the situation and know how to process what they're seeing. But the most important thing to remember is that their airways are still developing, and there is not an appropriate face mask that can protect them adequately from being at these destroyed locations.
All right, Lisa Almaguer with Butte County Public Health, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
One thing the reentry kit will not provide you is a warning for what you're about to experience when you get to the disaster zone. I asked my colleague, reporter Michelle Wiley, to join us. She's been up there. I've been up there. And I think it's worth talking briefly about what to expect. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Tess.
So you and I have had the opportunity, unlike a lot of people in the community, to go up and see Paradise, or what is left of Paradise. And I think what we want to talk about a little bit for the folks who have not been up there yet is that this is not something you can truly prepare for when you are heading up there. But it's something that you should bear in mind, that what you're going to see is extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, so I've been up there a couple of times, and you know, I come from the perspective of someone who doesn't live here. You know, my home didn't burn down, so even as an outsider, it's really, really hard to go in there and see everything. You know, a lot of the buildings have nails all over the ground from the fire. They have a lot of really difficult to, sorry, it's even difficult to describe because it's so
hard to look at, but like twisted metal, a lot of drywall that's fallen down. And when I was up there, it was raining kind of like it is today. And a lot of the drywall had sort of become like a plaster when it mixed with the rain, and it stuck to my legs and my shoes. And I don't say this to alarm anyone or to make anyone feel terribly concerned about going up there, because I understand why everyone's clamoring to get up there. But just keep in mind that it might be worse than you think it is, and to take a lot of care with yourself when you go up there. But what do you think, Tess?
I have to agree. I've been up there a couple of times now, and in fact, all the way up to Megalia. And I think what you cannot prepare yourself for emotionally and psychologically is the extent of the damage. You drive for miles and miles and miles and blocks and blocks, and it's devastating. You know, I'm not from here either, and I didn't lose anything in this fire. But that doesn't mean that you're not shocked by it, that your conscience is not shocked by it. And I guess, you know, what we're saying, again, as two sets of eyes that have been in paradise and beyond, is that you need to prepare yourself in any way that you can. But the damage itself is just, it's beyond sad. I don't know that there's even a word for it. And yet, I don't know about you, but it's also still so beautiful. You know, I talked in the show about a week and a half ago about how I can see why people would live there. I can see why they would want to spend time there, spend their lives there. It is spectacularly gorgeous. And that almost makes it worse, because there's this regal beauty to the trees and to the neighborhoods and to the landscape. And a lot of that is still there. The trees are still there. But when you see the destruction of a community, there are no words for it. And, you know, I guess what we're saying is to know that it's going to be really hard, and to allow yourself to feel that.
And just be mindful of your safety when you're up there as well. You know, I think people are really looking forward to getting back and sort of looking through and seeing what they can salvage. But like I said, there's a lot of hazards that might not be immediately evident when you go up there. So just keep your safety in mind, and keep your both physical safety and emotional safety in mind when you go up there. You know, Tess, you and I are both from the Pacific Northwest, so I totally agree with you. When I went up there, it reminded me a lot of my home. You know, the smell of the trees and just looking at the landscape, like, this is very much the kind of area that I grew up in, that my family is from. So being up there is a really emotional experience for me. I can't imagine what it's like for other people. But despite everything that's happened, I think it is such a beautiful area still. And I think when people go up there, they'll have a range of emotions and a range of experiences, and just be prepared to go through it. I know you've been going through it this entire time, but be prepared to go through it again.
All right. Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Tess.
Help has poured in from around the world in response to this calamity, but nowhere has the concern and care been expressed so deeply as right here in Chico. One of the biggest names in the area is even brewing a special beer. Sierra Nevada Brewery has put out a call to other beer makers across the nation, asking them to join in creating Resilience Butte County Proud IPA. All of the proceeds from this beer, sold around the country, will go to campfire survivors. NSPR's Sarah Bohannon talked with Ken Grossman, the owner of Sierra Nevada, about his creative and delicious way to raise funds for fire recovery efforts. She asked Grossman what sparked the idea.
You know, the idea came from some friends of ours, actually, who started a similar little fundraising project during the Santa Rosa fires. And we're good friends with folks at Russian River, Benny and Natalie. And so they put a call out, and we brewed a beer and contributed proceeds to the victims in that community. And so when the fire was burning, actually, Vinny got in touch with me, and we talked about it and discussed sort of how their approach went and what he would do differently. And so we crafted a plan that was a little bit more ambitious. I thought, I should be able to get 500, and so far we're well over 1,200. So we've really gotten tremendous support all across the country, and as I mentioned, around the world.
Can you explain a little bit more about how this is going to work with all of those breweries? Are they going to have it on draft and then all of the proceeds goes to campfire victims? How does it work?
The fundraising effort has two components. There's the one we're doing, which is we're brewing, at this point, I think over 4,000 barrels of beer. And that'll be mainly canned, but some draft as well. And that'll be distributed in mainly Western markets, but there's some other places around the country that have requested us supply them with the beer. And it was a big ask for us. So we asked our distributors to not make any margin. We've asked the retailers to not make any margin. So when you spend $5, the hope is that $5 will go directly into the fund. So there's nobody making profit along the way. At least that's our hope going into this. And we did the same thing with the brewing community. I put out a call to pretty much every brewery in the country, and today there's more than 6,000 of those. So I said, we've had a pretty significant tragedy here in our community, and we could really use some support. And what I put out to them was, I will work with the malt suppliers, the hop suppliers, the yeast suppliers to supply you with free ingredients. Your ask is that you brew a batch of beer, and depending on what your brewery size is, it might be 5 barrels, 10 barrels, 30 barrels. So fairly small batches in the scheme of things, and then sell it at your pub or restaurant, and again, give us 100% of the proceeds. So it's not that they're giving us profit, they're actually giving us what they sell the beer for. And they signed up in droves and can still continue to sign up. And so the hope right now is we'll be able to pretty easily eclipse $10 million going into the fund. And my goal is higher than that. We'll see if we can get there. But the money will come in over the next several months, since they had to brew the beer, they're gonna have to sell the beer, and then send the proceeds in.
When you put out that call, did you expect that big of a response?
No, it's been tremendously gratifying. I said I was hoping for 500 was my target goal, and I was hoping to raise $2 million. And we pretty quickly saw that we were going to go well past that. And I started having concerns that I had asked the suppliers of malt and hops around the country to supply free ingredients to these brewers. And I told them I have no idea, what the ask is going to be, because I don't know how many people will sign up. And they've been incredibly gracious. I'm assuming some of them are at their pain tolerance for giving away free ingredients. I think one of the malt suppliers was already up to well over 300,000 pounds of malt they're providing for the breweries. But people have been just fantastic. I had a malt supplier in Canada this morning reach out to me and say, if you need more malt, we're there to donate it to your customers or to your partners in this.
When will Sierra Nevada be releasing Resilience?
So we're brewing right now. We'll have the first batches out in about 10 days. In store, on draft, it'll be certainly throughout the West Coast.
And then for other breweries, that will just be being launched as they're brewing, is that correct?
Our hope was to get everybody to brew the beer sometime in November or beginning of December, as people's schedules were already full. Some people couldn't do it quite as soon as we wanted, but we've given a fair amount of latitude. As long as they stick to donating all the proceeds to us, we're sort of open with their time scale and interpretation of the beer.
And then is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Well, it's just been amazing time for people to come together in the wake of such a tragedy, but it's been great to see the human spirit and the ability for people to look forward as to how we get back to a more normal situation.
Ken Grossman of the Sierra Nevada Brewery talking with NSPR's Sarah Bohanna. And that is our program for Wednesday, December 5th, 2018, 27 days since the fire started. We are produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Special thanks today to Cameron Ford. Tomorrow, Jackie Sneed, the owner of Jackie's Hilltop Cafe in Paradise, talks about the future of her beloved restaurant. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.